My name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 5th, 1987. My name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. My home group's the West Portland group in Portland, Oregon, and I'm very grateful to be here. I want to thank Bridget for asking me, and welcome to all the newcomers, and congratulations to all the cake takers. I don't know if anybody will get anything out of anything I have to say, but I know that when I share my experience with the idea that it may help somebody, it enlarges my spiritual experience, and I get to stay sober, so I'm grateful for that. A little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was somebody who, I drank for 11 years, and for whatever reason, in those 11 years, my disease progressed very rapidly. I was arrested 15 or 16 times for alcohol-related offenses. I was in two treatment centers. I was in detoxes. I had three DUIs. I'm somebody that wet the bed on a fairly regular basis. I ended up becoming a daily oblivion drinker, no job, no responsibilities. I just drank around the clock, you know, blackout on a daily basis. And just to give you guys an idea where my head can still go today, a few years ago I was speaking in the meeting and I was standing outside before the meeting thinking how I was going to start in on my talk, and I was thinking about, well, just start with the, you know, the highlights or the lowlights of my story. And so I was thinking, okay, 16 alcohol-related arrests, three DUIs, two treatment centers, so forth. And all of a sudden the little voice in my head said, maybe you're not really an alcoholic. And I recoiled from that thought as if from a hot flame, which is not the way I once would do. You know, the crux of my disease is in my thinking. And there was a time before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous where that was the exact sort of thought that would take me to my next drink. I would say, maybe I'm not really an alcoholic, and then I would start to build a case on why I'm not an alcoholic, and I'd be drinking again. Those things, however, don't necessarily make me an alcoholic. They're a pretty good indication I had a problem with alcohol. But what I believe makes me an alcoholic is that all my life, when I wasn't drinking, I was somebody that felt different than, apart from, alienated from everybody. I felt less than everybody. I was one of those people that had an inferiority complex coupled with a superiority complex. I had feelings of anxiety when there was no reason to have anxiety. I had this sense of impending doom and impending insanity. And when I drank, when I had a certain amount of alcohol in my system, my magic number was 8 to 10 drinks, I got relief from that. 10 drinks made me feel like what you guys felt like, well, not you guys, but those people out there felt like normally. And that was my magic number. And the truth is that if I was somebody that could drink 10 drinks and maintain what 10 drinks did for me, and not lose control, I never would have come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Problem is I had that phenomenon of craving. When I had a certain amount of alcohol in my system, I would drink to excess, and I would totally lose control. And in the beginning, not necessarily every time I drank, but on an occasion, and then it became more frequent until ultimately I ended up becoming somebody that drank like that way on a daily basis. In the fall of 1985, I stepped over an invisible line with my drinking, and I crossed over from being somebody that would binge. I was a daily drinker most of my drinking career, but I'd go on like these 2-3 day binges. I went in the fall of 1985. I crossed over an invisible line where I became a daily oblivion drunk, and I drank to the point of either blackout or pass out every night. And I remember when I crossed that line about 3 weeks into that sort of drinking, I thought to myself, you know, my God, am I ever going to be able to stop this? And that was replaced with the next thought was, I don't care, because this is the happiest I've ever been. That type of drinking where I accepted that I'm a drinker and I'm just going to drink was a relief. Because up to that point, I'd spent a lot of time trying to control my drinking or trying to quit on my own, and I just had accepted that I'm an alcoholic, or I didn't use that term, but I accepted that I was a drinker. And, you know, I've heard that alcoholism is the only terminal progressive disease that has a fun phase. And that was my fun phase. But it was short-lived. Within a couple months, I was right back to, once again, trying to control my drinking. And by this time, though, it was just totally out of control. Every day I would come to, I'd go through the shakes, I'd have alcohol withdrawal, I'd hear voices of somebody when I'd come off of alcohol, I would hear organ music in my head and my name behind me, Chris. And I'd turn around and I'd have the shakes. I wasn't a shaker where, you know, when I would go somewhere, I'd, you know, shake like this, but I had the internal shakes. I could, you know, tremble in on the inside. And I'd come to in the morning, I'd put the night together, excuse me, the best I could, patched together the night before, and maybe there was some pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralizing thing, maybe there wasn't. I'd feel the guilt, shame, and remorse that I experienced every morning upon awakening most of my life, drinking or not drinking, and I would swear off. And I would, you know, this is it. I'm done. I can't do it anymore, so forth. And within a few hours, something inside my head would click, and I would either have a strategy on how today is going to be different and how I'm going to drink differently today, or it would just be, the hell with it, I'm drinking. And I would do it day in and day out. In June of 1986, I went out and tied one on and came to the next morning, one of the mornings where it was one of the pitiful and incomprehensible, demoralizing things. Came to, it was like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. Decided that I needed to wean myself off of alcohol. So I was living in a little town in southern Oregon called Ashland. And I went out on the freeway and hitchhiked up to Portland and decided I was going to, you know, wean myself off. The first night I was going to drink 5 or 6 beers. The second night I drank 3 or 4. Third night I was down to a couple, or maybe I didn't drink on the third night, I don't recall. But I got to that, the night where I didn't have any alcohol in my system, and I just fell apart. I was shaking, I was trembling, I was going through alcohol withdrawal, my mind was racing and so forth. I ended up checking into a detox. In that detox, they kept me pumped full of Librium for 5 days, monitored my blood pressure around the clock, and I knew all, you know, in that detox, even under the influence of all the Librium that I was on, what this treatment center was trying to do to me. What they were doing is they were trying to keep me in this detox longer than I really needed to try to convince me that I was worse than I really was, so I would join their 28-day inpatient treatment center, which I did stay for the 28 days, and I just wanted to get through alcohol withdrawal and then quit on my own. I didn't want to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. The God thing really was something that I resisted. And so when I got out of the treatment center, I did it on my own for about 14 days and started drinking again. From there, I went to a dry logging camp, an hour and a half float plane ride from Ketchikan, Alaska. And I got onto that island, and I worked for 3 weeks as a logger in this logging camp. There was no booze, you know, within an hour and a half plane ride away until two loggers showed up with a bottle of booze. And they asked me if I wanted to drink, and, you know, my mind very quickly went through the process of, well, it's been 3 weeks. I haven't craved alcohol. I'm probably not really an alcoholic, so it'll probably be okay. And I said, yeah, sure. Took the bottle, tipped it up, took about 3 big gulps out of it, and they grabbed it from me and said, hey, we got to make this last. I thought we were just going to drink the bottle. Now, I'm an alcoholic, so I suffer from the phenomenon of craving. And once I have a certain amount of alcohol in my system, I crave it. And I was an hour and a half away from the nearest bar or liquor, and I had about 3 shots of whiskey in me, and I came unglued. It was like an itch that I couldn't scratch. So the next day, I got on a float plane and went into Ketchikan. There was a bar there that was legendary for drinking and fighting and so forth, called the Fo'c'sle. And I went in there, and I went with this really good, nice guy named Dan, and we sat down, and after about 4 drinks, he turned to me and said, you think you're pretty badass, don't you? And the night just erupted from there, and I ended up in jail. And when they threw me in jail, they threw me in a holding cell with 2 other guys, and when I came to in the morning, the guy on the top bunk was hanging over his bunk looking at me, and I asked if, you know, if I could help him, and he said, hi. He goes, my name's such and such. He goes, I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got 30 days sober, and I'm in here doing 10 days of jail time because my sponsor had me come back and make some amends to the jail. And I remember looking at him thinking, my God, I can't even get away from these guys up here. And anyway, when I left, I left Alaska, came back down to the States, and ended up back down in Ashland, where I owed 8 days of jail time for my 3rd DUI. I did the jail time on weekends, and between the third and the fourth weekend, I was arrested again. And the police department in Ashland knew me on a first-name basis, and they took me aside and they said, you know, Mr. Clark, you've got a hell of a drinking problem. You've got to do something about your drinking. Go see this guy named Joe Fisher. He's an expert on alcoholism. And I was like, yeah, okay, whatever, you know. And next day I was walking down the street, and there was, in Ashland, there was this, like, sidewalk preacher, you know, that we, you know, towns have on their corner, and they had a Bible, and he was reading scripture to anybody that would come by. And the reason I'm telling you this story is this is a series of coincidences, or seeming coincidences that happened in my life that led up to me finding you. And I walked past this guy's name was Monty. I knew him from jail, and as I went past by, he read something from the Bible, and I took a few steps, and I thought, and I have no idea what it was that he read, but somehow it correlated between the scripture that he read and Joe Fisher, you know, the cop saying, go see this guy Joe Fisher. And I thought, if I was one of those AAs, I would say there are no coincidences, and that this is somehow a higher power at work, and that I should act on this. And I walked a few more steps, and I thought, my next thought was, you know, what would happen if for once in my life I didn't dismiss those sort of thoughts as being trivial and stupid and actually acted on it? And I thought for a moment, and just almost out of my own amusement, I decided to act on it and see what would happen. So I went up and went to go see Joe Fisher. Went into Joe Fisher's office, and as his secretary was getting him, I remember thinking, you know, please, anything but AA, anything but Alcoholics Anonymous. I was hoping that he had been through like the Schick Center, you know, 10 days, a couple 2-day follow-ups, and his life was wonderful now. And but that wasn't the case. I got in there, and Joe was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he did what AA members do, and he told me his story. And at the end of it, he asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting. And I didn't want to go, but I felt a sense of obligation to go since I asked him for help, and I went. And it was a Thursday night Clay Street meeting in Ashland, Oregon. And it was a speaker discussion meeting. The speaker would talk for about 20 minutes, and then participants would talk afterwards. And there was a primary purpose group. And what I mean by that is, rather than talking on some sort of topic, when there was somebody that was new in the room, they would talk about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And they started going around the room, and for the first time, I started to identify. I drank like that. I thought like that. I felt like that. And then there was this one guy in the back, I was sitting clear in the back, and this one guy, a couple rows in front of me, stood up, and he told a story about coming out of a blackout and having a revolver in his mouth, going back into the blackout, coming to on the floor the next morning with a revolver next to him. And that gave me goosebumps because I had almost the exact same thing happen to me. I went out one day and on a drinking episode, I came out of a blackout, and I was holding a carving knife to myself. And I went back into the blackout, and I came to the next morning, knife on the floor, I was in a chair, and the only difference between his story and my story is I had stabbed the furniture to death somewhere in the middle of the night as well. But, you know, I was, that was one of those things that I thought I was the only person that had ever done something like that, amongst many other things that I had done, but that was one of them. And so when I came out of that meeting, for the first time, I had a sense of hope. Now, I didn't stay sober. I did stay sober the next day, but I didn't keep going back. I didn't take the actions that were suggested in this program. And 6 days later, I decided I was going to one more time prove that I was not an alcoholic, or at least if I was, I was some sort of special version of an alcoholic who could actually control and manage my drinking. My plan was I was going to go out and drink 10 drinks that night, shut it down by about 10 or 11 o'clock, come home, get up the next morning, and be like a regular civilian. The guy that was supposed to pick me up to take me to the bars that night was running late. I drank 9 beers in my living room waiting for him to come pick me up. I ended up down in the bars. I was drinking vodka Collins at the one bar. Then I started going in and out of a blackout. And I ended up at my favorite drinking establishment in Ashland, which was Cook's Tavern. And Cook's Tavern was a place where you could pretty much get away with anything. And this night, they cut me off, and they'd never cut me off. And I had, earlier in the evening, secured a job at Cook's Tavern as a bartender from the bartender, Cliff. And I was a shoo-in for the job, which was a solution to my problem, you know, in my drunkenness. Is, you know, if only I'm a bartender, then I'll be okay. And anyway, Cliff cut me off, and so I grabbed him and pulled him across the bar and was going to work him over on the bar, and he weaseled his way away from me and called the police. And anyway, I ended up being arrested, and for whatever reason that night, something happened. And that was not a very bad night for me. I mean, it was a pretty mild night compared to a lot of my drinking, but something inside of me clicked. And I hit a bottom. In the middle of my drunkenness, I knew something had changed. They took me down to the police station, booked me, fingerprinted me, did all that stuff, and they took me home later that night. And my last conscious thought was, I wonder if I'll feel this way in the morning. And I did. When I came to in the morning, I was at a bottom. I was totally defeated. Death was a more attractive alternative than to continue living the way I was living. Had I had a crystal ball that morning that had said, if you just drink for the next 90 days and the next 6 months, I'd be dead, I would have drank till I was dead. I wasn't afraid of dying. I was afraid that I was going to continue living the way I was living for another year or another 2 years or another 5 years and continue to spiral down in this miserable existence of a life that I was living. And I cried out to a God that that I didn't want to believe in. And I said, God, please make this stop or kill me. And I surrendered. And I made the decision that morning that I would go back to Alcoholics Anonymous because of that Clay Street meeting where they carried the message so effectively, where I knew that people that drank like me were staying sober. And I became willing to do whatever they said. And if that meant believing in a higher power or a God, I would try to believe in a higher power or a God. And if that meant saying the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meetings and, you know, chanting, keep coming back, it works, I would do that. And I would do all the actions that they told me to do that seemingly had no relationship to what my problem was. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. They told me to get a big book, start reading the big book, get a sponsor, start working the steps, get service commitments. And they told me not to worry about the God thing. They told me that in the book it says that all I have to have is a willingness to believe in a power greater than myself. And that was enough of a foundation to make a start in this program. And so I did. They told me to fake it till I made it. One guy said it in a way that I really liked. He said, you don't have to believe in God to make a start in this program. You just have to take actions as if you believe in God to make a start in this program. And I could do that. So I started doing the things. I started praying to a God that I didn't know whether I believed in or not, and started taking the actions of this program. Now, the thing about me is when I came into AA, I thought I had two problems. I thought I was an alcoholic, and my secret is that I was crazy. And because when I wasn't drinking, I felt crazy. Now, I later found out that that's called alcoholism. See, my drinking didn't cause my alcoholism. I believe my alcoholism caused my drinking. That the underlying causes and conditions, that anxiety and depression and feelings of different than, that is the way that alcoholism manifests in my life. Drinking is a solution to that. I didn't know this at the time, but I found a guy, I heard him in a meeting, he said, I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy. And I understand that. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and we started in on the steps, and all went well for about my first 44 days. And at 45 days or 44 days, I had a panic attack, ended up in the hospital, at which I'd never had a panic attack before, which was a whole new experience. My first year was filled with panic attacks. Some of the other things had gotten better. I was somebody that was hypersensitive and hyper-self-conscious. When I wasn't drinking, I was somebody that when I was walking down the street, if I was walking down the street without alcohol in my system and somebody was coming the other way, I'd cross the street and walk down the other side of the sidewalk. Or if I managed to stay on the same side of the street as them, I would look at the concrete and just, please don't say hello to me. Please don't say hello to me. And those things were getting better, but this panic attack stuff started happening. And some of the other parts of the ism started bubbling up. And by the time I was 9 months sober, I was just coming out of my skin. And finally, what happened is through a story that I don't have time to tell you, I ended up being motivated to finally do my fourth step. And I got down, and I couldn't see how writing an inventory had anything to do with the fact that I was crazy. But I did it. And I'd gotten to a point, I'd hit another bottom in my sobriety, which was I'd come to the conclusion that, you know, I'm going to work steps 4 through 12 exactly as they're outlined in the big book and do as the people are saying in my home group. And when I get to step 12, if I don't feel better, I'm going to commit suicide. And so I started in on that 4-step, and I got together with my sponsor, and I read the 5th step. And about halfway through, or 3/4 of the way through the 5th step, we took a break and I went to the restroom. And one of the things that I used to do in the restroom when I wasn't drinking is I'd go to the mirror and I'd either build myself up or I'd tear myself down. And it would come from my soul. It wasn't a logical thing. And when I'd build myself up, it was fleeting because I'd always come right back to being a loser. Anyway, I turned to the mirror to do my normal routine and nothing happened. And I experienced something that I hadn't felt before. And I stood in the mirror trying to identify, what is this feeling? And suddenly I realized it was comfort. It was the first time I'd ever experienced comfort in my own skin without those 8 to 10 drinks. And I finished my 5th step. I did step 6 and 7. And and within a couple weeks, my entire life had changed. You know, internally, nothing had changed, but everything had changed. Internally, something had shifted. I became a person that now, I never worked once on self-esteem, and I started getting some self-esteem. I never worked on anxiety, and I didn't have anxiety. No, I shouldn't say that. I still get anxiety, and I still get a human emotion, but the exaggerated sort of emotion that I did from the disease of alcoholism. And that is when I believed that Alcoholics Anonymous would work for me in terms of my drinking, which would have been enough for me. But after doing that somewhere between step 5 and step 7, that's when I became a believer in this as a way of life. And that has been my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. I have just over 20 years of sobriety today, and you know, I don't do anything different today than I did when I got here. You know, it's still there's no graduate level Alcoholics Anonymous for me. It's still the same basic things. You know, my disease, it talks about self-centeredness being the root of our problem. And there's in the back, there's a doctor that describes it, which I like the definition better. It's the same definition, but the way he articulates it, I like better because it fits me. And it's the excessive concentration of myself. And that is the root of my problem. You know, I am like constantly monitoring, how do I feel? How do I feel? What am I thinking? How am I thinking? What am I thinking? You know, and it's through being God-centered and other-centered that I'm able to break that bondage and get out of myself and start to get some peace in my life. So I only have a few more minutes left, but in my sobriety, I'll say one more thing, or maybe two. One of the things all my life I was afraid to participate in life. I was afraid of getting in second place. If I didn't know that I was going to win, I wouldn't participate. And when I was about 2.5 years sober, I had an intuitive thought through prayer and meditation and trying to work this program where I realized that, you know, success and failure defined by normal people does not necessarily apply to me. Normal people, they step into the batter's box and they swing the bat, and if they hit the ball, that's success. If they strike out, it's failure. And it doesn't apply to me because I'm somebody that never would step into the batter's box. Success for me is stepping into the batter's box and participating in life and swinging the bat and leaving the results up to God, and regardless of what happens, whether I strike out or hit the ball, it is success. And after that intuitive thought, I got into a business. I got into the stock brokerage business. I was somebody that, you know, couldn't hold a job, was a daily oblivion drinker, became a stockbroker. From there, ended up owning a 50% of a brokerage firm, which I still own today. I have 40 brokers that work for me. I'm a leader of young men, you know, which is totally a gift from God. Through another series of coincidences, and I wish I could tell this story, I ended up with the woman I always wanted to end up with. My wife and I met in Cook's Tavern. And she wouldn't have a lot to do with me because of my drinking. And through a set of circumstances and coincidences, we ended up meeting up again in Laguna Beach and ended up getting married. And she's got 15 years sober and in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we've got a marriage, and we've been married almost 15 years. And, you know, I have everything in my life today, the way I feel, the way I think, the way I process you and the other information of life is all as a result of trying to live this program and trying to participate in it and really making, you know, putting first things first, still putting Alcoholics Anonymous and the spiritual actions of this program first in my life. As my wife says, when I do that, I'm able to move about amongst the earth people undetected. And I am. I'm still bodily and mentally different than my fellows, but I'm able to get out there and move about with the other people and participate in life. There's only been two things in my life that have ever worked. A certain amount of alcohol and a certain amount of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful I found this. You know, I was somebody that didn't like AA when I got here, and I fell in love with AA because of what it did for me. And I'm so grateful I did. And just in closing, I just want to say that Chuck Chamberlain used to always say this, and it's true for me, and that is today I have two choices. I could either live a self-centered life and suffer the consequences, or a God-centered life and suffer the consequences. Thank you.